Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Today, I've got Andreas Johansson of Nordic Resistance here with me. He's in Sweden. Hi there, Andreas. How are you?
Hello. I'm very good. Thank you very much for having me on. It's pretty nice.
It's a real pleasure. And I must tell you that you've got fans in places you won't expect. Here in South Africa, the man who I call my Boer Nazi pal, he is actually a university lecturer in scientific method, and he's a total National Socialist. And for people who don't know what National Socialism is, you know it by the name of Nazi, but the true term for it is National Socialism. So my Boer Nazi pal, as I like to refer to him, the only organization I've ever heard him sing praises to and talk highly of is Nordic Resistance. He says Nordic Resistance are the only people that are doing any good work in the world of whites, and he's a hard man to please, I can tell you. So that's one of your few supporters in South Africa. And he's one of the few who understands what's going on. The rest are still learning
a lot. Giving us hubris.
No, it's good stuff. So tell me a little bit about yourself and Nordic Resistance. How did you become politically active? How did the organization begin? What made you politically active, or have you been politically active for long? Give us some idea.
For sure. There's quite a big bag there, but I'll try to cope. Myself, I'm a real Swede, as you mentioned earlier, from Sweden. And I haven't had a long history of politics, I would say. I have been one of these kind of apathetic, non-political people that would be kind of a, hipster doofus, as people would say. Kind of a gamer, slacker, that didn't care about anything because, the world was pretty boring and I couldn't find any motivation in life. So I did have a period of feeling really depressed about 12, 13 years ago, when I was thinking a lot about, meaning of life and things like people think about. And it's things that I think a lot of young people that are feeling bad today, that are taking antidepressants, they feel like there is no meaning and that, the world is getting worse and worse. And what happened to me then was that I understood that I had to do something radical in my life to change the course so that I would have like motivation to continue in life. So what happened, ended up happening was that I just went with my friend to Australia randomly, just living my life in Sweden. I gave it all up and I thought, I'm just going to live in Australia instead because it's warm there. I don't have to suffer through winter anymore. And I spent about 2 years in Australia, and that's where I found my wife that I have today. But what happened in Australia to me, I thought I was going to flee my suffering and go to another country, basically on the other side of the planet, just to escape this feeling of, I don't know what it is, desolation, like meaningless stuff. But what I found out in Australia was that I didn't belong. I never felt at home in Australia. And after 2 years, I finally had enough and we decided to go back to Sweden. And this is the first time that I felt the attraction of the Nordic forest, like the Nordic soil, was literally calling me back. And I couldn't understand that feeling then, but I do understand it today, because now I live in a place where I was basically born and I always feel at home. I always feel like I am where I'm supposed to be. So it took going to the other side of the planet to get this feeling of Heimat, this blood and soil kind of feeling. And getting into politics from there, winding road, a long winding road. It's getting into truth or information, like What is money? How is money made? And, you know, does it even matter? Watching documentaries about how they make money out of thin air. I was going through a lot of this 2012 Truth or Movement, the occupation of Wall Street, and Zeitgeist documentaries, things like that.
Okay. I've got one of the Zeitgeists. It's excellent.
It's a little bit of Alex Jones and all that.
Yes.
But I settled after a while. I started listening to podcasts, and I started listening to a guy called Max Egan that was into a lot of truth or a lot of vibration and energy and reality and meditation and things like that. Kind of resonated with me. I was kind of a peace-loving hippie. But from there, through his channel, I found that he had been, or I think he was in connection with Red Eyes somehow.
Okay.
And I found Red Eyes Radio. And I would say that finding Red Eyes Radio, I would say going to Australia, finding my wife, going and finding Red Eyes Radio, things like this has changed my life forever. It's taken me on a path, you know. Just knowing that I'm on a mission. I have a purpose. And from there, I have learned things that, you know, you can't even imagine. From there, you have so many great guests on Red Eyes that I have then go on to follow, read their books, listen to their podcasts, viewed their videos and documentaries, and fell down the rabbit hole, literally. And at some point during this journey, and I know Red Eyes went through this as well, kind of simultaneously finding things like race, immigration, the importance of race, the importance of nation, and also Jews, Jewish subversion, Jewish identity, and also the Holocaust and World War II. And this is where things get into politics. And this is where I start looking for something in real life to get engaged with so that I can feel like I'm doing something. You know, a lot of people out there, they feel like they have to do something, but they just end up making internet memes, but they really want to do something. And that's what I felt. And at some point, it was actually listening to Renegade Radio, ironically, listening to Kyle on Renegade Radio saying that those Nordfront guys, you know, they know what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, I've been on Nordfront.se. I have to check that out. I have to go back and see what they're about. So I started reading and I found out that they were National Socialists. And I thought, wow, if I'm going to be a National Socialist, I want to make sure that I've got World War II, you know, straight. That I want to know what actually happened. So then I ended up watching The Greatest Story Never Told, because they had they had him as a guest on Red Eyes there. And that's when they actually got shut off of iTunes, incidentally, after that episode, when we're talking about The Greatest Story Never Told. And I sat and binged 6.5 hours of that documentary. And after I was finished, I realized that I was a National Socialist.
Oh, wow. This is like somebody said to me, that you don't, I think it's Savitri Dhavi who said, Devi, if I've got the name right. I think she said you don't become a National Socialist, you are born a National Socialist.
Yeah, you discover that you are one. Yeah, that's right.
Yes, and for me, if I may interject, for me it was a similar thing. Once I began to understand what National Socialism is, I then thought to myself, hold on, that's me. I've always been that. That's exactly what I am. That's how I think. That's how I work. That is what is natural to me, and it makes total sense.
Yeah.
But of course, if you go and read the history and the newspapers, you'll hear nothing but those terrible Nazis, never again, and don't let them exterminate the Jews again, and blah blah blah. And
yeah.
But that's the thing.
I already had, skepsis towards the mainstream. I've always hated everything that's mainstream. So doubting the official narrative wasn't a problem for me. Like, I really am curious when I hear information. I want to know more. So, you know, the official story was never a hurdle for me. I think maybe the label of being a Nazi, you know, now I'm living with it, but it takes a while to get used to knowing that people think you're a disgusting racist Nazi, you know, because they do when they don't know you. It's the people that get to know you or know you already. They say, well, you can't be a Nazi. You're too nice. You know, that's always what they say.
Yeah, very interesting. So if I may say, so your wife is Australian. She's born in Australia.
No, she's English, actually. So that's she's a coinkadink. You know, we were backpackers. So.
Okay. So she's moved into your world, but that's excellent. So you've married a white woman from another white country. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
That's right. And so, I felt like I had the English language with me. So I thought about what I could be doing for the movement. And that's kind of what I've utilized when doing activism. So I do the English speaking podcast and run the English speaking website to spread awareness internationally using the English language, which I've always wanted to speak English. You know, I think that was my only dream. And that came true. that's one of the reasons why I went to an English-speaking country like Australia as well. I didn't want to go to, you know, where I had to learn another language. I was pretty lazy, I think.
So your background, you say you were like a gamer, hipster. Were you, what sort of work were you doing? What sort of background were you? You sound almost like you were a bit technical. If you were a gamer.
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of noobish technical, but I didn't have any work really. I did work within elderly care for many years, taking care of the elderly. And, you know, ironically, they raised the standards for your regular undernurse. So you would have to go, I would have to study 6 months to become one, and I just didn't want to do it. I didn't want to get caught up in that because I wasn't really happy. It's very depressing work, I'll tell you. It's horrible. Not because of old people, it's because of how, you know, the medical industry is, the health industry, with the forced medication of the elderly, making them prematurely demented and depressed, and their lives are absolutely, you know, pointless and disgusting. So I didn't want to do that anymore. And that's when I ended up being just unemployed, doing nothing, feeling like everything was pointless. So
you have no purpose.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you have any religious background? What was your religious outlook, if any?
No, I was always an atheist, you know.
So you were an atheist, so you weren't a Christian, because I believe Christianity was big in Sweden at some time, and I don't know if it still is.
Yeah, in some pockets, I would say further down south, there are pockets there that are very, they have a strong religious history, but I would say that's all mostly ripped out of them now. The Swedish church is a joke, and being religious is basically, you know, is looked down upon in Sweden today, I would say.
Ah, that's interesting. That's interesting, because I was hearing from a friend of mine in Denmark that, you know, in Denmark, people don't even know, most whites don't even know and don't even care who this guy Jesus is. So so it's very interesting about Northern and Western Europe moving away. And I was wondering whether Sweden was like maybe still more religious than the other parts, but it's very good to hear that in Sweden you people have moved on. And the Dutch, you know, before I traveled, I've not traveled much, but I've only been to Europe once, in the sense that I went to Holland for 3 days or so for a conference. And I found in my few travels to whether it was Holland, Canada, or America, I found in my travels that when I go to a place, that the things that other people have told me about that place, that my view of that place is different to what I've read. I used to believe that Americans were all degenerate and backward. And when I used to have a Jewish friend, my best friend was a Jew. This was before I became Jew wise. And I'd talk to him about Europe, and we'd talk about the future, and he'd say, "Oh, the future's so great. You know, China's rising, India's rising, but Europe is dead." And I said to my Jewish friend, why is Europe not going to rise?" "Oh no, because you know Europe is an old continent, and the people are old and tired, and you know there's nothing that's going to happen there in the future." And I couldn't quite understand his hostility. Later on, I also saw that the Jewish experience in Europe, you could see, oh, you know, they hated the Christians of Europe. And then just to show you what a hypocrite these Jews are, then one day I said to my Jewish friend, "So why is China rising?" And he's saying, "Well, it's because they're an old people with an old civilization." He's saying the exact opposite. In the case of Europe, he uses the same argument, but gives you the opposite outcome. And because I've always been drawn to European history, always, even as a youngster. We used to in the colonial times, we used to learn about the history of Europe as part of our studies. And when I was a kid in Rhodesia, we did O levels, which is British exams. So we had to learn the same history of Europe and Britain that the kids in Britain learned. And that is where my true fascination with history began, was actually by learning about Napoleon and the Napoleonic Wars. I became so fascinated by this guy, Napoleon. And I used to think to myself, how is it that one man can achieve so many things? And Napoleon is my original true thing that drew me to European history. And I've always liked European history. It's alive, it's vibrant. There may have been lots of wars and combat and arguments among the people, but I always found that it was a higher civilization that you're dealing with. With Europeans, you're not dealing with the low level of the blacks of Africa, guys running around with spears. When you're dealing with European history, you're dealing with sophisticated white people, and they are thinking sophisticated thoughts, and their actions and plans are so incredible, they are unmatched. Nobody else can match what they can do. And that is where whenever I wanted to read history, my history has always been European history. I find myself drawn to Europe because Europe is excellence. To me, Europe represents excellence. And the fighting among the different nations was minor. What was more important was the excellence of the people. And you could see the excellence shining out from different nations at different times. So,
Yeah, definitely.
and Europe to me, as I look at it now, it's a fantastic place still. And I'm seeing that European science, especially in quantum physics, European science is now leading the world. And I'm so pleased with that because I know that the brightest people are there. But going back to the Dutch, what I wanted to say, because I've been sort of going around in circles here. I looked down on the Dutch before I went to Holland. I looked down on the Dutch because they were liberal, and I kept hearing all this liberal talk among them. And I thought, these people are idiots. How can they be continuously talking liberal nonsense? And when I went there, was actually I was there on the days when America invaded Iraq. And so while I was there for this weird conference, there were some Dutch guys actually just talking a little bit about the American invasion of Iraq and what was going on. And as I listened to these Dutch and as I observed the Dutch around me, I immediately began to realize, you know what, these people might actually be talking like liberals, but these people are not stupid. And that was my first takeaway from Holland. These people are not stupid, and these people are organized. And they maybe just believe some of this stuff because they don't know better, because they just fed the wrong information. My trip to America and Canada, in Canada, I met lots of the right-wing groups, including many National Socialists, and I had the most wonderful discussions with them. And I just walked away. My big takeaway from my American and Canadian trip this year was simply that the only reason that white people are liberal is because that is what they are told from the day that they're born. They are lied to every day of their lives, every day of their lives. And they are inundated with mountains and mountains of information, misinformation about liberalism. And well, that's the only reason.
I have a theory about, especially the educated liberals, you know, they can be very intelligent people. And the reason why they can entertain these advanced ideas that contradict nature in all its points is because they have a high IQ, that they can use this intellectual jujutsu to just get this thing to work in their brain, whereas more primitive people like blacks and Arabs, they're more natural, they're more instinctive, so you can't really fool them in that way. They will stay the same, and they will keep to their tribe, they will be loyal to their family, you know, all that stuff. Whereas you can teach a white liberal about universalism, you can teach him about everyone's equal value, that you have to love everyone equally and all that stuff. No one else is buying that. It's only whites, mostly, and Jews that are perpetuating it, of course.
Absolutely. And you know, if we can still talk about how the blacks evolve here in Africa, because they do evolve, but they don't evolve in the way that you expect to evolve. They can, when they evolve, they can even devolve. And when you leave these people alone to their natural instincts, like you say, they are racist. They are also, by the way, the blacks are utterly sexist as well. They are completely, when you leave them to themselves, they are racist among each other. They even tell jokes about their different races, and they have no problem with it. It is only when white people start talking about, you know, if a white person were to make a joke, a racial joke, then it's an evil thing. But everybody else, you watch the others, and you will see that their behavior is completely not what the liberals are predicting. And also, I think people can entertain liberalism when you are far enough away from reality, and you are living in a safe country where you don't feel threats and you don't see non-whites every day and you haven't seen them in their natural state, then it's easy, because it's like living on another planet. It's easy to start imagining that life can work this way. But that has been the problem in Africa, is that the whites in Africa, because we are surrounded by these people and we see them every day of our lives, we know what they are like, and we know that they are just, you know, when they keep telling you how clever these people are and you work with them every day and you see, but no, they're not as clever as the liberal is telling you, you know, those things help to feed you reality. And that is why whites in Africa resisted black rule and resisted those things, is because it's on their doorstep. And even if they're Christian, they can still see it openly, and it's hard to convince them of something that they can see every day. But I think in Europe and America, it's been much easier for them to con the whites, simply because you don't have those people on your doorstep every day and you don't get to see them. But now they are coming into your countries. And my own thinking is that unless the Jews are very clever, that more whites are going to are going to wake up to the fact that these races are different. I don't know how your experience has been in Sweden and Europe when you see these people coming in.
Yeah, it's many-folded, the reaction to the invasion, but it's becoming apparent now in Sweden that it's a problem. And even the mainstream has been forced to admit that we're having problems with, they're calling it integration, of course. We just need to put some more money there, put some more money there, maybe a football for Mohammed so he has something to do, because now we've had a lot of bombings lately, and especially in Malmö, but just yesterday there was two bombings in the Stockholm area. So it's getting pretty intense on the streets with gang war. It's territory war and, drugs and guns that they're running in Sweden. We've had op completely open borders for about 5 years now, or 4 years, going on. Stefan Löfven, our prime minister, he said that he was going to close the borders, but it's fake, because while he's saying that in the mainstream press, is having a press conference, people actually believe that we're taking in less people. But this isn't true, because all these people, we had about 300,000 people in 2 years that came in 2015, 16. They're now bringing all of their relatives, of course. And it's anything from their neighbor to, distant relative, whatever, from their country. So we're taking in 120,000 a year now, just relatives and refugees. And
What
it's yeah.
is the white population of Sweden
Well,
in
it's
numbers?
speculated to be, 7 to 7.5, I think.
Million.
Yeah. Million, yeah,
Okay.
that's true. It's 10 million total in Sweden, and we're looking at 10% Muslims and almost 30% non-whites in general. So, and it's hard to tell because they don't run any statistics on these things, because that would be racist. So you can only find them by their names, because by the time they are second, third generation, they're counted as Swedes. So then they're really hard to actually find, and they might actually be named, Johan or, Jonas, whatever, Andreas, even. But they're black as night, and they're from Africa, two generations ago. So it's getting very tricky, and they're obviously trying to blend out Sweden as much as possible, as quickly as possible, because Swedes are reacting. They are reacting, and the reaction is to go to the Sweden Democrats. Because the Sweden Democrats have, by the mainstream media, been pointed out to be the boogeyman. It's the racist party that's against black people. So when people get upset about mass immigration, they think that the Sweden Democrats is the solution. Whereas the Sweden Democrats themselves say that they're not against black people, they're not against integration. They would love to have better integration. That's one of their main points. And they're not talking about repatriation. They're only talking about taking in slightly less people. That's like slowing down the decay slightly, even though with the people we already have within the borders, it's a catastrophe waiting to happen within one generation. We have to start sending people back, preferably last week, in the millions at this point. So
Wow,
yeah,
so
they think then that the Sweden Democrats is the solution, and they vote for the Sweden Democrats, and they see no results. The Sweden Democrats are soaring in the polls, but the Sweden Democrats aren't doing anything. They have been in parliament now for more than 8 years. It's 10 years now they've been in parliament. They have done fuck all this entire time. It's
wow.
amazing. So.
Now, is your politics, I assume that your politics is Jewish controlled, like politics in every Western country, the way where all the main political parties have got some kind of liberal Jewish donor sponsor, elite sponsor of some kind that pumps money into that party?
Yes, We certainly do. And obviously, the Sweden Democrats are the worst. It's the biggest Zionist party. They're the part of the kosher right, as I call it. You know, they love Israel and, you know, they
Oh,
hate
what?
Muslims, or they're skeptical against Islam or whatever. But they love black people as long as they're not Islamists. You know, they're just fine. But what's interesting about other parties is historically, for example, the Social Democrats, they have a back and forth history because they're obviously communists. They love the left side, the left side of Jewry, but they're against Israel because they're pro-Palestine. So they have a
Right.
very complicated relationship with Jews in Sweden, because when Israel is committing genocide, the Social Democrats will react and be like, "Oh my God, we gotta boycott Israel." And then Jews gets really upset, and then they don't know where to go. They don't understand Jews, how they play. So that's
Yes.
interesting. Whereas on the other side, you would have someone like the Sweden Democrats that are just pro-Israel, and you know, they're not communist. They're not for the left side of Jewry. They're the right side of Jewry. So they're playing both sides. And then being part of the Nordic resistance movement as a national socialist, you can see how the Jews operate within our own government without, you know, explicitly running the government, because they never do that. They always go from behind the scenes. And what they've been doing to Stefan Löfven for the last few years, which is our social democratic prime minister, he's been going to Auschwitz. You know, he's been going to, what's it called,
What?
Yad Vashem in Israel,
What
and
it?
learning about the Holocaust. You know, it's very important that he remembers.
That's true, because I've heard of I think American senators. I think American senators especially and have been going to Israel to learn.
Yeah,
And
to
oh,
never
you
forget.
the scale on which, you know, the scale on which these people can lie, I mean, it's right out of Mein Kampf, eh? You know, where
Yeah,
Hitler
it
says
is.
nobody will conceive of telling a big lie, just like straight up front. And there you see the Jew, man. He's just doing it straight in. He
Yeah,
goes
and this,
straight to the top. In
and I would say that this is a reaction against our success, you know, not to be on a high horse here, but we had a big demonstration in Gothenburg in 2017, and this was following many successful demonstrations in Stockholm and in smaller places like Ludvika and in other places. And the movement was growing. There was a momentum in National Socialism was being exposing Jewry in Sweden,
that's
and they
nice.
had to put a lid on it because it was looking too good, because we're not Nazi thugs just randomly beating up people in the streets. We're sophisticated. We do write nice articles. We have nice podcasts, nice media. We have nice marches and nice gatherings that you can come to and see that we are real people for real, being National Socialists. So going to Gothenburg in 2017, they pulled out all the stops. You know, they brought the entirety of the Swedish police force to the city that day to oversee our demonstration. And the week after, I believe, there was this top EU gathering. So they were kind of practicing for a big demonstration, they were saying anyway. So they had obviously a big anticipation from the left. Gothenburg was filled with communists and Antifas and all that on that day. And they had prepared these holding cells for demonstrators, which they could arrest in place. You know, and there was actually along our marching route that we were going to have. But we had a plan. We had a route that we were going to walk through Gothenburg, through the city center, to be seen by the people, and then our speeches would reach the people. And it was fine. They left it. And I think it was about a month before, maybe more, they started not talking to us. Like the dialogue police started communicating with us. And then all of a sudden, this national police force got involved, and they changed the route and they changed our gathering time, and they said that we weren't allowed to do this and that. And the police chief for the Gothenburg area, Erik Nord, he had then put ultimatums on the movement, saying that we weren't allowed to have our flags, we weren't allowed to have marching uniforms, we weren't allowed to walk in pace, we weren't allowed to shout the slogans, you know, together as a choir, you know, because it would look too much like the 1930s, you know. We would be too much Nazi if we did that.
Yes.
Yeah. So they had that as an ultimatum, and he had these leaflets printed out that he gave to all the demonstrators when we had the gathering on that day in Gothenburg before the demonstration. There were policemen handing out leaflets, obviously not to the hardened members, but they were going around to our sympathizers, you know, saying that there was a point list on this flyer saying that if you do this, if you do that, if you do that, that might be hate speech and you might be reported for a crime. So think very carefully before you walk in this march, you know. And the media had blown this thing completely out of proportion to scare people from coming to our demonstration, you know. So you would expect that only the most bravest, you know, most dedicated nationalist slash national socialist would actually turn up, because it's a guarantee that your face is going to be on the streets. They're going to take photographs of you, they're going to publish you in the media, they're going to smear you. And so they managed to scare so many people off and have everything in chaos. And I believe in the end, before a few minutes before we actually started marching, we got news from an inside source within the police saying that the police was going to try and apprehend us. They were going to take away our flags to provoke us, and then they would arrest anyone that would fight against us. And this is this marching route that they had settled outside of the center of Gothenburg, where we get to walk 300 meters, you know. Can you imagine a train of hundreds of people walking 300 meters? It's basically over in 5 minutes. Yeah, exactly. And we had a gathering time for 2 hours, whereas we wanted 6 hours to begin with. So we just couldn't take this. So there was a march to then the start of the march that we had. And it was during this one that communists were throwing obstacles or objects at us from our flank, that, well, we famously turned left and ran straight into the police wall. And after that, we were held occupied for the entire day. So that's a little bit on the story of why the prime minister has this attention from Jews. Because as this demonstration was being planned the weeks before, we had visits from the World Jewish Congress, Robert Singer. He had a private meeting with our Minister of Justice, Morgan Johansson, and sat down with him and said that, you know, you can't have National Socialists walking on your streets, man. You have to do something about this. And you have to oversee your hate speech laws so that people can't do this anymore, because this is clearly anti-Semitic and horrible. So that's what happened then, that the consequence of World Jewish Congress coming, putting pressure on the Social Democratic government, meant that the police was now threatening us. We are citizens of Sweden, having a legal demonstration with a permit, marching with our flags, that is our organization's symbol, legally. They're threatening us with hate speech because they have decided that this might be a crime. And it's completely out of the Jew's mouth, you know, it's completely out of the Jew's mouth. And being on the inside, I mean, you can you can notice this stuff, but that's how Jews influenced the Swedish government to fight the rise against the invasion, so to speak.
Now, if I may ask, how many people were you expecting at that march before people were intimidated? How many were you expecting, and how many in the end? Because clearly there's a lot of intimidation and all kinds of cunning trickery that's going on in the way that they're now re-mucking you around and changing your stuff and seeing to it that you can't really succeed. How many were you expecting, and how many actually pitched eventually?
Yeah, so we were expecting or hoping for 1,000 people. That was our goal with this
Okay.
march. And we managed to count over 500 people, but it was
That
very hard because the march never started and we were never had a real gathering, so we couldn't count people properly. But around 500 people came in the end, and a lot of people say that they couldn't reach the gathering place because the police said no. And it's always like that. You have to be, when you're marching with the Nordic Resistance Movement, you have to come early to the gathering place so that you can get in and talk to us. Because once the thing is rolling, it's impossible to reach us because they always enclose us into this box so that we can't reach people. It's absolutely oppressive. That's what it is.
Well, all I'll say is that if you got 500 people out of your original 1,000, that's actually excellent.
Yeah,
Because
it is.
I would have thought that given all the weird nonsense and scare stories, that they would have chased away a lot more people. So that's still very good going there. So tell me a little bit about Nordic Resistance as a concept. How do you guys function? What are you trying to do? And do you have members? Do you count your members? How have you been growing?
Yeah, I can tell you some brief history about the movement. It was started in 1997 by Claes Lund as a National Socialist organization, and the goal was always to unite the Nordic nations into one National Socialist Republic, which we call the Nordic Nation,
And
together.
which countries would that be?
It is Finland, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and Iceland currently.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So,
Nice. Including
yeah.
Finland. Nice to hear about the Finns because I'm quite a fan of the Finns and their 1939 Winter War. But
Yeah,
we'll
they're
talk
pretty
more.
based. They are. But ironically, they were the first to ban the Nordic Resistance Movement. I don't know if you've heard about that. You know, they have
No,
a history of
I didn't.
being.
I
Yeah,
didn't know that.
so they have a history of being actual national socialists fighting against communists.
Yes.
And yeah, so how long ago is it now? Like 2.5 years ago, the Nordic Resistance Movement went to trial in Finland. And it was a very vague law that they used against the organization. It's something like going against good customs. As an organization, you have certain rules and regulations that you have to uphold. And because the Nordic Resistance Movement wasn't even a registered organization, it was just a loose gathering officially on paper, you know,
Yeah.
in Finland. I don't know, they deemed it illegal, and it was to be disbanded. And the court case was an absolute joke. They had witnesses from the secret police in Finland that witnessed and said that this is a very well-run organization with, discipline and high morals and, basically good quality people. They're not, to talk us up, but it was like, this isn't your ragtag neo-Nazis on the streets getting drunk, beating black people up. That's basically what they were saying. This is an organization that might actually make a difference. And yeah, they don't like that, obviously. And then you had former leader or former chief of the Finnish branch talking. He wasn't in the court. He wasn't even a witness. His book, like, he's one of these snitches that has jumped out of the movement and started smearing us and are now working for these anti-racist campaigns in Finland. Henrik Holappa. His book was used as a reference in the court case. So he wasn't even on the stand able to lie people in the face. They used his lies in his book as evidence against the movement. So it was a complete farce, but they decided to ban the movement. And now currently it is going up to the highest court in Finland. So it's being appealed. But while awaiting the highest court's ruling, the movement is disbanded currently. So the Finnish branch is currently out of order officially.
Oh wow. And this court case must be costing you people quite a bit of money.
Well, it's costing them a lot of money. I don't know. It's costing us a lot of money. It's costing us a lot of time and effort, for sure. But you've
obviously got Finns in Finland who are very keen to be part of Nordic resistance. So they're busy fighting that angle, I assume.
Yes, we do have very good members in Finland. There is an issue, though, with some of these. It's not specific to Finns, but this ethno... chauvinism, where people feel like their ethnicity and then Finland is more important than the Nordic, whereas we have a world view where we see globalism being inevitable. You know, it's gonna try and swallow the earth, this globalism thing, and a way to fight that is to gather in a biggest unit as possible, but still being able to be united. And we feel like the Nordic people are unique in that sense, because we've been spared race mixing for thousands of years being preserved up here. And we are very, very well related to each other. People argue that Finns are different, and they might be, but it's proven beyond anyone's doubt that Finns can live in Sweden and Swedes can live in Finland without a problem. So we believe that we can... You don't have to give up your nationality just to be part of the Nordic nation. I'm still going to be Swedish. I'm still going to be living in Sweden and living where I am. You know, I'm not going to give that up just because I want to have a strong state with a united people that is run with national socialism. I think it's an absolutely beautiful idea, and it's something that is, you know, it's a vision that is that can motivate people to fight to the death. You know, it's absolutely amazing idea that we would come together and become this strong unit between 25 and 30 million people having natural resources to be able to sustain ourselves inevitably, you know, forever. It's quite an amazing feat if people would just understand that this idea is absolutely brilliant.
So you would call your National Socialist State would be called the Nordic State.
Mm.
Nordic State. And it would be composed of Finland, Sweden, Denmark, and?
Norway and Iceland. And we have had a branch in Finland, but we currently have branches in all the other Nordic countries.
So your population would be between 25 million and 30 million.
Yeah, whites. So yeah, to get rid of the blacks.
Whites only. High IQ, very purely bred white people. That would be something. That would make you as strong as Canada. You'd pack a punch. 25 to 30 million white people will pack a punch. Mm-hmm. Especially at the high IQ and we add in some of those wild Finns. And you know something? In my own ignorance, I didn't realize about the Swedish Empire. But I mean, Sweden used to be a kick-ass country. I mean, you guys were the first guys that I know of in Europe who invaded Russia. I was absolutely fascinated by that king of yours. Was it Charles the 12th?
That's right.
And you know, I mean, Sweden used to be a kick-ass military power. And you played a big role in the 30 Years' War. And yeah, I think you guys could be quite a freaking kick-ass country.
This is another hurdle, you know, that I joke about all the time because I'm part of the Swedish master race. But you have other countries thinking that Sweden will just have this, colonialism again, you know, colonizing the rest of the north. But isn't the intention. No, because I feel like, any nationality within the Nordic nation can become the leader. It's not about Sweden being ruling this thing. It's just that it started in Sweden. It is biggest in Sweden. Sweden is the biggest country with the largest population as well. But it, most importantly, it started in Sweden. So it has had time to grow. It's been around for 20 years. So, of course, it's biggest in Sweden and most strongest in Sweden. So, but that is, that's not necessarily in the future, you know, whereas when the thing develops, we'll have completely different things. And then you have people that are bickering about the language, you know, how we're going to communicate. Well, how do we communicate today? You know,
I was going to ask you, how are your languages? Do you people naturally understand most of your languages from neighboring countries?
How does it work? For example, Swedish is a base language for Norwegian and Danish, and the Danes and the Norwegians will probably when I say that. But I feel like the Sweden is like a base language, and Norwegian is one version, and Denmark is one version, whereas Denmark is very mixed with German, and it also has a lot of it's way quicker. I can understand Danish really. But I can understand Norwegian if they speak slowly. It's apparent, and it's very close to Swedish. But then you have Finland, which is a completely different language. It's an Eastern language that has a completely different sound system. So, I would say that to begin with, it's English for most of the time. And obviously, you also have the Icelandic language, which I feel is very back to the roots. You know, the Danish people and the Vikings fled to Iceland and preserved themselves on Iceland, having these Nordic blonde giants over there. This like a eugenics project going on that island. Because as we were discussing before we started recording about how whites have moved around the world, going to Iceland, you know, on a fucking rock and building this nice little nation that they have now, high technology on a rock. When I know David Duke, he compares it with blacks in Haiti, you know, when the blacks took over Haiti, they turned it into a shithole country. Whites went to a rock on Iceland, and they made a paradise, you know. They have a nice little paradise, nice white paradise over there. So that's the difference between blacks and whites building societies, I would say.
I can add something to you. There are a handful of black Zimbabweans who I used to work with some black Zimbabweans at my last job. And at one point, some of them, they do gain some respect for the white man after they've seen what they've done. And one day, a black Zimbabwean turned around and he said to others, he said, if you put a white man can live anywhere and make a success of anything. He said something along those lines. And he said, if you were to put a white man in the desert, then he will succeed there as well. And he actually gave us his example, Las Vegas. but the point is the same thing. And actually, you can see that clearly in South Africa, by the way. In South Africa, among the many, many lies that they tell you, oh, the whites took all the best territory and the best land. Total rubbish. Do you know that some of the nicest places to live in South Africa are all along the East Coast? Natal, where the Zulus come from, it's luxuriant, it's green, it's got a nice high temperature, lots of growth, etc. All down the East Coast of South Africa, it's beautiful, lots of rain, things grow very easily, and so forth. And yet you will find In the Kalahari or the Karoo, I forget now which one's which, you'll find that in the inside of the country where there's semi-desert, and I tell you, when you go there, it looks like you're on the moon. The first time I went through that place, I looked at this out of the train window when I was young, in the 1980s, I looked at this place. It was so barren. It looked like the moon or Mars. You just see freaking rocks, and all the plants are dead. There's absolutely nothing there. And you know what? You will find whites who farm there, who grow up there. They love it. And they're absolutely totally at home over there. And it's whites who actually live in the worst places, and they are completely happy, and they don't have any problems. Whereas go to Natal, where the Zulus live, it's the Natal and the Eastern Transvaal are amongst the most beautiful, luxuriant parts of South Africa, and the blacks live there in large numbers, not the whites. You know, whites can live and thrive everywhere, no question about it. And I totally support everything you're saying. Totally.
Yeah, and the more, you know, the worse it is, the more they struggle and the more they evolve, you know, they become stronger, smarter, faster, harder.
Well, you know? I think our history bears that out, and that is a whole other topic, you know, about the real struggle of the white man, because whites are very different to the others. I've got many things that I've noticed between the different races, and I've observed us, because I've also even worked in like multicultural, multiracial environments, because we've got Indians. We've got Indians as in Indians from India. The Americans would call them East Indians. We've got coloreds. Coloreds are mixed race. They're like basically half black, half white. There's sort of a mixture of that. And you can see the different personalities and characteristics of these different races when you put them together. And I can tell you the whole thing is very dysfunctional. And it's just been interesting observing the dynamics. And I've still seen how whites absolutely rock here in Africa. To give you an example, I've seen, like in computers, I saw how in one place where I worked in the bank, they had a point where the entire computer department in this section was composed only of white people. So there were like 13 white people who ran this thing. And 13 whites did all the work that was necessary for this entire contact center with 1,000 people as staff answering phones. Later on, they made it multiracial, multicultural. The contact center was still 1,000 people answering telephones, answering the same calls and emails that they used to answer. And the IT department went from being 13 people to about 150. Same things, more or less, very dysfunctional. I saw them, they would replace like two white women with about 20 blacks. And later on, even when they got themselves more efficient, it was still like 15 mixed race people doing the work that previously used to be done by like 15 by two white women. And I saw that over and over again. I've seen the total shambles that multiculture brings to you. And then I've observed the whites, how the whites function either by themselves or in a group. And I got to tell you, all these things have shown me is that white people totally rock, totally rock. If whites can function as their own group, don't you worry about being outnumbered, man. Whites can pack a punch. And that is why these Jews are busy mixing and integrating people. They are deliberately creating a chaos that they can manage. And they're still going to be turning those people against the whites and other whites against the whites. And this thing is malicious, really.
Yeah, the thing is, I was thinking about it earlier today, actually, about multiculturalism and how there is no white person ever that came up with the idea of multiculturalism that thought that, oh man, it would be great if we brought in some blacks here and lived among us, you know. This has always been a Jewish idea, and I'm talking going back thousands of years, how Jews always felt comfortable in the suburban areas or in urban areas, and always being an urbanite and always being among whites and other people. And when they're there, they're causing all kinds of ruckus. But because there's all kinds of ethnicities around, no one's going to pay attention to the Jews. And this is what you're seeing in Sweden. And that was a point I was going to make earlier when we were talking about Swedes waking up. So you have Swedes waking up to the Arabs. They're causing a lot of trouble. Some of them are gangsters. You know, they are blowing things up. They're shooting people. They are raping. And then you have the issue of Islam and the mosques being built and the prayer calls that are being done in Sweden. This is then pushing people to the so-called kosher right. That is the Sweden Democrats that are against Islamism, you know. They're against just the religion, you know. They're not ethnically inclined. They're not talking about race. They're not talking about white Swedes. They're just talking about Swedish values, if that. I think they've even stopped talking about that. But these people that wake up, it's such a long step for them to take to understand that Jews are behind why Arabs are even in the country. You know, Arabs didn't find their way to Sweden by happenstance.
They were led.
Someone came up with the idea that they should be in Sweden. No Swede came up with the idea saying that, wow, it'd be great if we had some Turks in here, and then suddenly your neighborhood's turning to shit. No, they didn't. This was completely contrived by Jews in the 50s and 60s. They were writing articles about how immigrants' cultures should be preserved. They shouldn't be forced to assimilate, you know.
Oh, wow.
Their culture and their religion intact. And this was then, back then, Jews were talking about Eastern Europeans, you know. Maybe some Catholics would come. Oh, my God. But obviously, they had a longer plan, because these people think in generational. They're intergenerational in their struggle. So yes. Today, they're only talking about how Islam, of course Islam, belongs in Sweden. You know, seeing these people walking around in hijabs, it's very Swedish. You know, you have H&M and IKEA and everyone having interracial ads. You know, of course black people were in Sweden. You know, black Vikings, you never heard of it? So it gets more and more absurd. And then he had a lecture about 3 years ago by a Jewess called Ingrid Lomfors. She's the head of an institution called the Museum for Living History. Taste that, Living History. So she's having a lecture to the Swedish elite and the king and the queen sitting in the crowd about how everything that is Swedish culture is imported. You know, there is no such thing as an innate Swedish culture, nothing native about being white and Swedish. This has all been, you know, imported from somewhere.
Sweden was created by immigrants.
Exactly.
And now you need new immigrants to continue the evolution of Sweden.
We can't make our own things, you know. We're so boring, us white Swedes. We had such a boring life here, living in peace. Now it's so exciting. We have pizza, we have kebab.
isn't it like the Jewish woman, Jewish professor Barbara Spector said to you people? That,
that
you're going to have to learn to become multicultural, and the Jews are going to be resented because they're on the leading edge of it. But if you don't become multicultural, then Europe will not survive.
Exactly. And that is, you know, per word, true what you said there. And in their vision, Europe will not survive because they won't survive. Europe has to become multicultural so that Jews can survive in Europe. And they know it, you know.
My friend, you are so on the money. I was going to say to you that is typically the Jew. The Jew comes and he tells the white person something that is excellent for the Jew. It's bad for the white person, but he markets it to the white, says, oh, this is going to be so good for you too. In fact, this is what you want. You know what gets me about these people? People, the Jews are going on about, the Jews are the most. People have been treating them so badly. People have been so nasty.
Persecuted.
Yes, we are the most persecuted people around. You know what the truth is? The truth is that Jews are the world's biggest spoiled brats. They are the biggest spoiled brats among whites. White people allow Jews to do things that no other group on the planet allows anybody to do. The notion that Jews are persecuted is the biggest load of rubbish imaginable. It's the complete opposite. And there you talk about the Jewess talking and giving a lecture to the king and the queen. That is typical. Look at Britain. When the Jews get up and they have a problem with Alison Chablot or somebody, what do? The Jew gets onto the BBC. Mm-hmm. Now you show me a normal white guy in Britain, see what his chances are of getting onto primetime BBC. Yeah. That doesn't happen. And you'll just keep on seeing this stuff. Do you know who Donald Trump appointed as the newest ambassador to South Africa? He's appointed a white Jewish woman from South Africa who left South Africa and now lives in Florida. And he's taken this Jewess and made her the new ambassador to South Africa. She was clearly a white liberal. She used to she made money out of handbags. So she was obviously like a socialite, upper class type in South Africa, making good money in the times of apartheid. Then she obviously left when the blacks, communists, were making life tough here. And now guess what? She gets chosen. How is it that one Jewish woman gets to be chosen as the ambassador of South Africa? Meanwhile, if Trump had wanted, there are hundreds of thousands of other whites that he could have chosen from. But of course, a white will never get that position. But you know, these Jews get into everything, and you'll see them always straight in at the top, man. Yeah. Straight in at the top.
You're familiar with the Echo meme, where you put triple parentheses around Jewish names on the internet.
Yes.
Now there's a new one with the blue man, where they have colored all the characters that are Jewish in a picture with blue. So you can see all the Jews in the room.
You know, and something? I wonder if that isn't something from Dylann Roof. Because
might be.
You know, Dylann Roof, in his manifesto, in Dylann Roof's manifesto, he said something like, if we could turn all the Jews blue, we might be surprised at who would be there.
Yeah, exactly.
And I wonder if someone has taken that idea. Oh, wow. Yeah,
it is absolutely brilliant. Because what I'm thinking is, if they're like 0.02% of, you know, population of any given white country, why are they fucking everywhere? Why are they everywhere in the media, in the banking, and in the behind the scenes in politics? And they're running all these kinds of NGOs, and they have like five different Jewish interest organizations in each white country. And when you see these people in the media, they are writing, they are editors, you know, they're producing movies, they're producing TV, they're fucking everywhere where it matters, you know, where the message is being pushed out and where decisions are being made and where money is being lent or borrowed and now lent. That's where they are. So if you just color those people blue, you'll notice that there's no way that there's so few Jews, you know. There has to be more. It's crazy.
Well, that is a whole other topic as well. I completely agree with you. Is Jewish census statistics? You just don't know when they are lying, and those numbers, they change those numbers according to what they need at that point in time. The thing about Jews that I've seen, whether it's the Holocaust or anything else, Jews invent all the necessary facts that they need to tell the lie that they need to tell at that point in time. Jews don't need any real facts. They'll invent everything immediately, and then they'll tell you these are the facts, and off they go. You've never come across such a race of bold, lying, bullshit artists as Jews. It just stuns a person. just leaves me amazed.
Yeah, for sure. And that's where I feel that I'm frustrated is with these, I call them Sweden friends. They're the nationalists that have woken up to mass immigration and they just can't see beyond Islam. They can't see beyond the mosques and the shootings. It is just symptoms of a problem, but it's not the problem. So getting these people to become national socialists is a great task. I believe that we should only aim to find the so-called player characters, the people that have their own agency, the people that already have freedom of thought and have curiosity and open mind, so that they're willing to, by themselves, accept these ideas, do their own research and find national socialism for themselves. Because it is true, all roads lead to national socialism. Doesn't matter where you're starting out, just keep walking and you will find it in the end. And yeah, finding these people in Sweden in the current year is it's frustrating, but I feel like more and more people are waking up, and it's kind of our goal to make the Jews the main target of the conversation.
Beautiful. I'm listening to what you're saying, and I love your take that all roads lead to national socialism. I've never thought of that. One thing that I have thought of that I've realized is that all roads lead to Jews.
That might be the same thing.
And maybe national socialism is just the next step after Jews.
But it's the antithesis. It's the medicine. It's the thing that's going to cure the world. You have the disease and you have the cure. It's the same thing. It's the same conflict. Yes. And this thing is going back thousands of years. You know, call it Rome, call it what you want. There's always been Jews there in the background, behind the curtain, pulling the strings. So you had different kind of authoritarian governments, white countries, regimes. They were overturned. And a lot of them, you will find, were crushed by multiculturalism and race mixing. And today, you can go to the Middle East and you can see the results. You can go to Iran and see what's left of Persia. It's fucking gone. But at the same time, there's a lot of white Arabs. I know we spoke about this before as well. There's a lot of white-presenting Arabs coming out of that region. These are people with higher intelligence and more Aryan than other Arabs, such as these Afghanis that we've been getting lately. They're not the same people. They're completely different. So
this discussion that you're talking about, this is a thing that we talked about before the show. And just for our listeners, the two of us were talking before the show, and we were talking about what the white race has done in ancient times. And the two of us were comparing notes about the fact that whites have been everywhere on the planet, and we created other civilizations, and then those civilizations became mixed up and they were destroyed. But the prime moving force were whites. Whites were the ones who created those civilizations. And for me, in the case of the Persians, it's kind of funny. I quite enjoy the dynamic between the multicultural Persians and the ancient Greeks, who were more pure whites, and how a tiny white country eventually smashes and crushes a superpower. And I try to explain it to people in the sense that imagine that Cuba and the United States went to war, and the United States tried to invade Cuba, but Cuba smashed their army and invaded the United States and took over the United States. That is the kind of dynamic between the ancient Greeks and the Persians, the way that I see it. And that to me is yet another example of how awesome whites are. When they are in their own territory, even if they're a small group, they pack a punch. We can pack a punch like nobody else can.
Yeah, definitely. But that's also what I feel about Southern Europe and also the Middle East that is bordering it. This area is mixed. There's a lot of Europeans that have darker skin today than they had thousands of years ago or hundreds of years ago. So this mixing is going on. You have Spain as well, that was invaded for 700 years, that
Yes.
had Muslims living there, making the whole Spanish population slightly darker than it was before. So for it to come up here to the north completely artificially, completely imported, there's no logical reason why these people are here. It is like soiling something that has been preserved and refined for, like I said in the beginning, thousands of years. And when it's done, when the Swedish people have given up and they have let themselves become a minority and the rest will just mix themselves out, then there is no more places to go on the planet. We have retreated to Europe already. We have stayed here and lived in peace together for a long time. But once this thing is gone, it's gone. And that's why I feel like uniting the Nordic nations and going by national socialism is the only solution. And like you say, when white people come together and they create things, I think all we need is self-determination. We need a so-called white pride. We need to be proud to be white
Yes.
again. We need to be
Yes.
realizing that we have a very rich history of accomplishing impossible tasks in the past. So this thing of sending these people home is actually no problem as long as we have a political will. There's absolutely no
Yes.
problem.
Yes. This I agree with you totally. That the main thing holding up the Western world, the main thing is just all the Jewish nonsense at high level in politics, in business, in culture, in the media, in everything. Jews are the biggest influence on whites. They're a terrible influence on whites. And that if whites were left to be themselves and whites had to find themselves, whites will actually be completely different. And I don't know if you know this, but I originally come from Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. And one of the things that I've seen in studying the short history of Rhodesia and our final war against the blacks is, and I was trying to explain this to other Rhodesians, but they're all too old and too depressed to listen. But I was trying to explain to them that if I look at what we did in the final years when we were fighting the blacks and we were doing our utmost to win, that if you actually look at it, you'll see that the whites were becoming nationalistic and the whites were sticking together to preserve white power. And the whites were pulling out more and more, whites were going to greater and greater extremes in order to win. And even though whites only made up between 4 to 5% of the population of the country, we still ran the country, controlled the country. Most of the army was white, and we were packing big punches. We were doing things that no other white colony did, because basically we were a rebellious British colony. That's basically what we were. And when I look at the way whites react under strain, that's when they become themselves. That's when they become what they were. The natural animal that's sitting inside starts coming out.
Yeah,
And
the struggle.
it doesn't even need any education. In fact, in my lecture, 50 Years of Race War in Southern Africa, I spoke about military tactics, and you'll see how this relates back to the rest of Europe and to our heritage. I explained that when the whites and the blacks started fighting, when the communists, Jews, and liberals started arming up these blacks and brought these blacks in, that when we started fighting in the beginning, we were fighting guerrilla warfare. We did not want to fight big battles. We only wanted to engage in guerrilla warfare. We tried to do things with minimum force and everything. As time went by, without the whites even studying any of our history, any of our ancient history. Just through logic and struggle, the whites discovered over time that fighting small battles wasn't working so well. We were winning, but it was a lot of effort. And what we discovered was we found that we could actually fight bigger and bigger battles, and the success would be greater and greater. And by the time we'd finished our 14 years of war, we were starting to move into the European way of fighting, where we gathered larger numbers of troops, attacked bigger things, caused much more injuries and deaths on these blacks. And we found that fighting bigger battles in the European style actually worked. And later on, South Africa, because it had a bigger army and a more sophisticated army, it took it to its natural end result, where ultimately they were fighting with artillery and tanks in Angola in the bush. And so what I was saying is that whites, without having any preconceived notions of history or their past, just naturally began doing things that our ancestors used to do, and it worked perfectly well. And we found that the dynamics of doing things that way works the best. It's totally logical, and you end up doing that. And I'm starting to think that with regard to whites, with regard to Jews, etc., that it may be that in the stress of globalism, that even Jews themselves are changing into being more Jewish the way that Jews used to be. For example, when they went and created Israel, Israel is the first time that the Jews actually tried to create a state with an army, etc., etc. And I've actually watched Israel, and I reached the conclusion many years ago, before I even woke up to the Jewish issue, that Israel is actually not as successful militarily as it used to be, and that the Jews are actually needing to move away from nationalism, because nationalism is not working for them so well, and they're using more their Jewish trickery and high-level stuff. And you'll see that Israel itself operates in a Jewish manner. Military people from Israel go to America. They steal people's technology and science. Then they come to Israel and they start a business and they sell it all to the Chinese and the Russians and everybody who's an enemy of America. You know, so I think what I'm trying to get at as well is that when people are under stress, and this is a very important point for multiculturalism, that multiculturalism is a thing that this thing can only work in very placid circumstances. The moment that a society is under stress, you will find everybody starts reverting to what is natural for them. So this is part of why I think that the future for whites will be more racialism and more nationalism. That's what I'm thinking. And maybe for the Jews, the future is be more Jewish, infiltrate more things, try and screw it up from the inside. But
yeah, I think they're biting off a little bit too much, more than they can chew with this. And the more nationalistic, I think they're trying to control this nationalist wave, because they know it's happening. I mean, it's inevitable. And they're creating this kosher right. And you have all these based politicians in white countries like the UKIPs and the Sweden Democrats, the True Finns. There's one in each country, one kosher alternative for the right, so-called anti-immigrant party that people can vote for. That's the steam valve for people thinking that they're doing something. They can vote for, I'm not sure about Salvini yet, but you know, he's been kissing that wall in Israel like all the others. So I have no trust in these official politicians. They're fake. It's all theater.
Is Salvini in Italy?
Yes, that's right. And he's being praised because he's sending boats back, you know. And he's very loved by Italians right now because he's speaking up about rapes, that the rapists need harsher punishments and they need to be sending more people back, which sounds really good. You know, it does sound really good. But if you've had the kippa on and you've been kissing that wall, I have no confidence in you. I only believe in National Socialism. And that's basically the only thing you can run without going and kissing Jewish walls. You know.
Bingo. I'm completely with you. I used to follow the British National Party and John Tyndall in Britain. Mm-hmm. And I could see that the British National Party is starting to take off. And they are nationalists, and Tyndall himself is like a closet National Socialist. And then I could see that, oh, goodness, look at this lot. UKIP, where did they pop up from? And next thing you see is all the Jews that are linked to it. And then you see that UKIP is siphoning all the people from British National Party into UKIP, and British National Party goes downhill. And that was the first time that I saw this kosher nationalism coming to the fore. And like you say, it exists everywhere. You've got, what's that guy in Holland, Geert Wilders?
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
And he's the same thing. So Jews are playing a management role. I did an audio recently called How Jews Think. And the sort of brother audio to that I've not fully finished is called Jews Are Managers, Whites Are Workers, where I look at the dynamic, the mechanisms for us fighting against them. And you'll see the Jew is top down. He's operating from the top down. He's always operating at high levels and pushing the whites down. And the whites who are fighting the Jews are common workers. They're just common people like you and me, just from the ground up. And it's a rerun of Hitler. It's a rerun of that game. It's the bottom versus the top, the common working guy. Mm. So, you know, history is playing itself out again.
Yeah. And I think they're biting off more than they can chew now with this nationalism, because once this nationalism turns National Socialism, it's going to hurt, and it's going to be 110 times that they get kicked out.
I hope so. That is my dream.
Because we were discussing it just yesterday on our podcast, that just 200 years ago, they were banned from most of the European countries, you know, or they were just about to get let in, and they had limited rights in the country. They weren't allowed to settle down wherever they want. They weren't allowed to run random businesses. They were, forced to do what the white society wanted them to do. But little by little, you know, they started advocating for their own interests. And lo and behold, today they run our societies. And I was asking the question, well, if you have the argument that Jews are so smart that they deserve all this power, you know, they're so creative, so they have Hollywood. They're so smart, so they have all the banks, and they have all these organizations that basically dictate world policy. Well, are they making a nice world? Are we happy? Is it beautiful? All this degeneracy, all this basically just drugs, porn, and violence. That's what we have our culture is. And then this multicultural cesspits that are cropping up all around white countries. Just look at Paris today. It's a fucking shithole. I don't want to go to a big city again. I don't want to go to Stockholm. I don't want to go to Gothenburg. I don't want to go to Malmö. These things are lost. They're so disgusting that they have to be cleaned up before they're safe again. And it's all because of Jewish policy of multiculturalism that was supposed to be so amazing. And all the arguments that they have had over the decades that, well, Europeans are growing old, Swedes are growing old, we need someone to take care of them when they're older.
Nonsense.
All right, so we'll bring in brown people that are also old, so we have to take care of the old brown people as well. But like ignoring that, you have subpar brown people taken care of or elderly now. And then when that doesn't work out, when them coming in for work and supporting the tax system doesn't work, when you find out that 90 or 80% of the newly arrived, they're still unemployed after 5 years. They're unemployable, actually. A lot of them are actually illiterate. They can't even function in white societies. That's what we've gotten from this recent refugee wave, anyway. So that argument is gone. Then they have that you have the empathy. You know, we have to help these people. They're refugees. And we're finding out that a lot of these people were living in peace. Like, for example, 10,000 Afghanis were given amnesty last year when they found out 78% of these Afghans had been living in peace in Iran for many years. You know, they weren't even fleeing Afghanistan. They were coming from peace and, you know, basically just living a life in Iran. And they saw an opportunity to pretend to be Syrian, because a lot of these people are registered as Syrians. And now the largest minority in Sweden is Syrians. They have replaced Finns as our largest minority. It's insane. Wow. And they're not even Syrians. They're just a mixed bag of Arabs.
So
we have to take care of these people because they're fleeing war. All right. Where's the war then in Iran? Where's the war in Somalia? Where's the war in... we have people from Zimbabwe even.
They are liberated. Really? They're living in freedom. You got some Zimbabweans. Zimbabweans.
Yeah, that's right. We have Zimbabweans and we have Kenyans and everything. You know, so there's no official war in these countries. It's ridiculous. And the war in Syria is over. So why don't we start sending these people back? No, they have to become Swedish. You know, this is the argument. They're refugees and they're here now. So they have to become Swedes. And this is a really strange thing that most Swedes don't think about, that a refugee is fleeing conflict. When the conflict is over, you're supposed to send them back, you know, to help rebuild the country. But this isn't even happening. You know, no one's arguing for that. Not even the Sweden Democrats are arguing for that. And after that, you just have them being poor. And the latest thing is climate change. You know, the you have climate refugees from Africa now.
No,
fleeing the climate. So it's crazy. They just keep making up new excuses for why Sweden needs to be brown, you know. Well, and
in my videos, I talk about the word of sophistry. I don't know if you're familiar with the English word sophistry. But sophistry is an argument that sounds logical, but it's not logical. And I must tell you, the arguments these Jews can come up with, the bullshit that they can think up. And I mean, just a few final words. I mean, with regard to Europe, why is it that only non-whites can get to Europe? Why can't I, as a white South African, be a climate refugee from South Africa? Can I get into Sweden as a climate refugee? And no. And the other thing is, if the problem is these old populations of whites that aren't having children, why doesn't anybody ask the logical question, excuse me, why can't whites just have more children? Why can't the state make it so that the whites have incentives, etc., to have more children? And wasn't it Jewish feminism and stuff that drove the white women out of marriage and all that?
Yes, you know, it's more common to have broken families today than having parents actually staying together because of this feminist division that we have in society, where women are obviously encouraged to have a career, they have to study, and they become super big brained and they become a CEO and they get to push papers for the rest of their life. They push off having children until they're in their early 30s. And then they've been on birth control their entire life since they were 16. Their, you know, thing isn't working properly for a long time. It takes a long time to get that thing rolling. And then they might discover that, oh, they're actually infertile. There might not be any children. Or they might have time then in their 30s to have two children. So they get to be an old mother in their 40s. And yeah, and then you have, well, them being pushed out into the workforce means that, you know, daycare and school is basically raising the children in Sweden. The state is the new parent for the child. And it's actually mandatory to go to school. I don't know if you know that either. There's two countries in the world that I know of that have mandatory school, and that's Germany and Sweden. And, you know, that's because National Socialism is very much in our veins. So they have to stop people from thinking for themselves. They have to send them to the indoctrination center. So you have that. You have the man and the woman having to work, whereas before you had one wage household and the woman maybe working a part-time job. That was common in the 80s and 90s. That's basically completely gone now. And then if they even stay together, let's say they stay together, you have that kind of situation. A new study showed that parents in general in Sweden spend about half an hour of active time with their children every day. That means that they get up in the morning, they drive their children to school where they spend time before school starts. They spend time there eating breakfast at school, and they then go through school, and then they might pick them up later from school around 5 o'clock. You know, so they have a day from maybe 6:30 to 5 o'clock every day. They come home, they might have to go shopping, cook dinner, you know, all that. And after that, they get to sit down for half an hour to read a story, and then it's bedtime. So that's how the Swedish family unit is if they stay together. But like I said, most of them are broken up at this point. So we're seeing, I would say, very destructive tendencies or trends in the Swedish family unit. And this doesn't affect the non-whites. You know, the non-whites are pumping out children like nothing's happening now. This comes natural to them. Having a big tribe means a lot of power to them still, because they have their instincts intact. Whereas white people are supposed to think about the climate. You know, we're supposed to have anxiety about overpopulation, where, I mean, whites are like less than 6% of the world population at this point. We're supposed to feel bad about the CO2. You know, we're supposed to feel bad about driving to work so that we can pay taxes for the state.
All of that stuff is nonsense. All of that is just big rubbish. I mean, here in South Africa and Africa, there are many things I could show you where you'll see that all this propaganda, all this Jewish crap is just being fed to white people in Europe and America, North America. You people are just inundated with all kinds of Jewish nonsense. It's all totally malicious and self-destructive. And the thing about the Jew is the Jew can do maliciousness in such a pleasant way. Oh, you see, we're just trying to help you. And this is because we've allowed this parasite thing into our existence. They've messed with our heads. And I agree with you. National Socialism is really the way to go. Back to nature. Like I'm explaining, some of the lessons learned in Africa, which whites themselves in Africa don't even appreciate, show us that, you know, return to our old ways. One thing I will tell you in my study of whites and our history in Europe is that all our methods are extremely efficient. Our way of thinking and our way of cutting through the bullshit and doing things, all of our ancient past, and even right up to more recent times, let's say even right up to World War II almost, there's a lot of stuff in our society that's very efficient. And our ancient thinking is very efficient, very sharp, very well thought through, very well cut out. And that makes us, our society is always structured around very firm rules. And we are very disciplined people, actually. And that system is a very powerful system. That system is a system that's allowed us to go across the world, conquer, and settle in virtually every place you can imagine. And that system, if that system were to be brought back and tied in with our modern science and technology, we're the gods of the earth. We are the gods of the earth. There's nothing less than that. I truly, and you know, when that horrible, hideous little Jewish scoundrel, Barbara Spector, when she said, "Oh, Europe will not survive." No, you stupid Jewish bitch, you lying, two-faced scum. Europe is going to survive. And you know what? Europe is the greatest superpower in the world. When I look at all these other so-called superpowers and I look at them from a military perspective, most of those superpowers don't amount to a hill of beans. The original superpower is Europe. Europe conquered Africa. Europeans conquered Africa in 20 years. They conquered 90% of Africa in 20 years with hardly breaking into a sweat. Countries even like Belgium and Holland and those, they had freaking huge chunks of territory in Africa. And whites are, Europe is the only superpower that exists. Even America is a second-rate superpower compared to Europe, in my opinion. And I think that for whites and for white survival, Europe is the critical, critical thing. Europe must come first. Europe must come first. I'd say that all whites everywhere should swear loyalty to Europe. Europe first. Because if Europe can be saved and turned around from Europe, we can regain anything that we had. I believe big time in Europe. Our cleverest people, our purest people, and National Socialism anyway, whites who've been doing some wrong breeding with our science and a little bit of discipline and some eugenics, we can start fixing ourselves. But I firmly believe we have to have a white society that benefits whites, no Jews present. You cannot coexist with them. It's totally impossible. It's totally impossible, I think. So yeah.
I
Anyway,
agree, for sure.
so I think we've had quite a discussion today,
Yeah, for sure.
and some very interesting things. Andreas, it was very awesome talking to you. I'd like to chat to you again, and maybe we can talk on other topics and so forth. We can keep in touch. But I'm glad to see that there is somebody in Sweden fighting away. That is
Yeah.
very important. You know something? I think we need some stress and strain in our lives. Then we'll stop worrying about all these other junk things and start actually
Exactly.
learning real values that mean
Yeah.
something.
This is what we're saying about the coming collapse in Sweden. It's going to be an economic collapse pretty soon. It's going to be
Really? Oh, wow.
yeah.
Good.
We're seeing the Swedish kroner is basically tanking and becoming useless, and then we're going to have the mortgage. The interest rates have been on a negative for years. It's been an unprecedented economic boon in Sweden for the past, I would say, 5, 6, maybe 7 years. Because of this low interest, people have been borrowing a lot of money, getting themselves in insane debt, because as the interest rate has gone lower and lower, the prices of houses has gone up, and you have regular working people buying houses for millions of kroner. And when then that interest rate turns around, these people are going to be homeless, and they're not going to be able to sell their house. It's going to be a shit show. And then that's when people are going to realize what's important in life. And I think a lot of people are going to have different priorities when that happens. So that's something that we're hoping for. It's going to rustle some people from this material slumber that they're in, obsessed with gadgets, these bug people.
And the gadgets themselves are junk gadgets as well. I look at gadgets that are useful, and then I look at a lot of junk that just comes out of factories. It's just rubbish. I've even in my own life here, I've even been looking for things that are like very simple, very old things, that are very cheap that work, that you can just pick up that the blacks actually buy. And then you look at the same rubbish that comes out of some Jewish internationalist factory. It's got a whole lot of bells and whistles, most of which you don't need. And I'm looking at a lot of stuff, and I'm just saying that these people are just creating all kinds of new rubbish, abusing our technology, and flooding people with junk that they don't need. Cars for me. The way cars are built, there's a whole lot of junk technology that goes into a car that you don't really need. A car, the way, you know, let's go back to Hitler's VW Beetle. That car had most everything that you need in a car in order to drive. Cars have had all the things that they need for almost close to 100 years. You don't need all the other junk that you're paying money for, you know. But
yeah, that's true.
I think the Jews are gonna. I think the more that whites leave Jews, one thing I would suggest to you is be more proactive. Do not expect a collapse. You will be astounded at the kind of Jewish rubbish the Jews can think up in order to survive the next thing.
Yeah,
nothing ever actually collapses, and they're in there with some new bullshit Jewish idea.
I think it's actually an active tactic of theirs to put this collapse into people's minds. You can see this in Hollywood movies where they're promoting this end of days, doomsday wasteland movies like Mad Max and whatever you can find. People find this fascinating and cool that we will be living in this wasteland. And a lot of people are sitting around waiting that things are going to collapse instead of actually making something out of themselves and creating something that's, you know, worth fighting for. The Jews are doing that all the time. They have, like I said, an intergenerational struggle strategy. They're always building. They're always networking with each other. They're always, in the end, agreeing with each other, you know. And whites need to do the same thing. They need to build themselves up and have something in their life worth fighting for. Just waiting for the collapse is not good enough, because you're going to be useless once it comes. Like these prepper people, for example. I'm not saying that these people are useless, but if you're only expecting yourself to live in a bunker in a nuclear wasteland, you know, that's not how it's going to go. It's going to be a slow decay. And you have seen it yourself in South Africa. It's going to be a slow decay. It's going to take decades, but it's going to be more and more suffering. And the more you have built yourself up, the more you can withstand these this hard times that are coming.
I think there's quite a lot I can tell you about South Africa and the slow destruction, because I've watched it in Zimbabwe close up, spoken to many people, watched it in South Africa. I completely agree with your viewpoint that you've got to be proactive and you've got to do stuff other than just preparing for guns and nuclear war. The prepper thing, I agree with you. There's a more intermediate space you've got to get into. And that intermediate space is a thing that interests me a lot. That's why I'm doing a lot of the stuff that I'm doing on the internet, because I still want to talk more about that intermediate space, because I believe that this intermediate space is the place to fight. And I will tell you that in South Africa, if it wasn't for the creativity of the whites, South Africa would have collapsed a long time ago. In fact, whites are so adaptable that even as the country is being mismanaged, whites are actually continuously saving the country from collapse. And this is no doubt going to be what you guys are also going to face. Don't worry about the big collapse. Worry about the slow collapse. And you know something? My view is that when I've looked at whites adapting, I tell you, if we adapt and we work together like the Jews, we're going to whip their asses, because there is nothing that a Jew does, nothing. And you raised the question, how clever are these people? And my answer is they're not that clever. They just managed to wangle their way to the top, and then they befuddle everybody at the top, the king and the queen, just like the British royal family, the presidents, the prime ministers. They befuddle everybody at the top with all their Jewish nonsense. But I will tell you that if whites start developing a will to live, and National Socialism is the perfect thing here. If whites start developing the will to live and the will to stand up for themselves and fight back, Jews are not that clever, and there is nothing that a Jew does that is actually difficult or dangerous. They're a race of cowardly people, and their common tactic is to lie or backstab or betray somebody. They don't even have the guts to stand up in front of somebody and face somebody who's going to try to kill you. White men are much braver than any freaking Jew, and there is nothing that they do, as well as what we used to do with our bravery and our courage and stuff. We've got more than enough skills with which to defeat these people. We've just got to get ourselves away from depression, on the one hand, extreme depression, and on the other hand, endless hope. I find with Christians there is endless hope, and they're always hoping, and you've got to get away from that. You've got to get into more practical things. And once you start doing something for yourself, building your own life, liaising with other whites, I'm telling you, the Jews and everybody else, they're in for the struggle of their lives. Once whites start working quietly and carefully, we're going to beat them all. In that sense, I don't know if you've followed Ben Carson, the creator, the man who created the creativity religion.
No, I haven't.
He wrote a thing called the White Man's Bible. And he basically took National Socialism and he basically created a religion for whites only out of National Socialism. And the movement he created is known as creativity. The top preacher, you could say, Matt Hale, he's been sitting in jail for many years. Now, Ben Carson, in his book, he said, if the whites of the world will stand together, we will be 10 times as strong as everybody else put together. And when I put that out on my videos on my channel, there were supporters of mine who said, nah, if all the whites of the world stand together, we won't just be 10 times as strong as the rest of the world. We'll be 20 times as strong. In fact, one of my friends even said we'll be 100 times as strong as everybody else put together. I want to tell you, that notion is so freaking true. I can show you piece by piece, step by step, why I firmly believe in that. That all we need is white unity and white standing together. All of us descended from Europe, us standing together. I'm telling you, the entire world will not be able to stop us. Nobody will be able to stop us. Not the Chinese, not the Jews, not anybody. And you only have to look at World War II and see what the Germans did. How many empires the Germans, 70 million Germans and some of their allies, and how many empires they had to fight. And it should be clear to you that, you just increase that number of National Socialists just a little bit.
Yeah, and like in a three-front war, they were, industrially gassing 6 million Jews. They were amazing. I mean, never heard of anything like that.
While creating rockets, missiles,
Yeah.
jet engines, all
Lasers.
kinds of unbelievable things, and they still had the time, and they still had the time and energy to send trainloads of coal to burn all the dying Jews. Oh
Yeah.
man. And they nearly won. They nearly
Yeah.
won. They came
Wow.
so freaking close. I mean, truly, I don't see how you can walk away from that with a negative view. So anyway, I think we can wind up a bit. Is there anything else you want to say that
Yeah, for sure. I can plug our website, NordicResistanceMovement.org, where where we publish activist reports. If people are curious to see what we're up to, we have videos sometimes on the bigger activities and written activist reports. And then we sometimes translate some opinion articles from members and leading members. Sometimes there's a few from Simon Lindberg, the leader of the Nordic Resistance Movement, and other members writing about National Socialism, writing about Nordic politics and how Jews have influenced the Nordics, and how National Socialism is natural to the Nordic peoples. And you can also find, under ideology on the website, you can find our political program, our path, where we step by step, it's a 9-point program where we talk about our political will, you know, about closing the borders and sending the strangers home, shutting down all foreign media, things like that, taking control of the banking system, taking control of our own lives and uniting as a Nordic people. And then we also have the English-speaking podcast, Nordic Frontier, which I'm the host of. We do a live show every Tuesday at 8 o'clock Swedish time. So you'll find all of that on the website.
So, wow. You guys are really organized. You guys are standing out. That is awesome stuff. Well, it's been awesome talking to you, Andreas. It's been a real honor. Been a real honor to meet you and finally talk to you. And I'm looking forward to many more chats with you and your organization. And I'm sure that as we compare notes, you will see we whites can help each other. And I say, you know, those who think that white people are going to die out, we will see who's going to die out. I don't believe whites are going to die out. I think we have more than enough willpower. We just need to dig into our ancient past. And something I've even joked about here that I'll say is I was talking to a young Boer. I did an interview with a young Boer the other day, and I said to him, you know, the whites of South Africa may only be 9% of the population, but if there were to be a true race war, if these people truly want to fight us, I still think that if we just got our act together in true white style, that you might actually be surprised and shocked by what would happen. And don't think that just because other people outnumber us that we're just going to fall. And a German friend of mine who's a National Socialist, whom I've known for many years, he always tells me, and he lives here in Africa, and he always tells me the following thing. He says, the white male is the only male, the only, let's call it human male on the planet, who will fight when he's outnumbered. And that is true to our race. Wow. We've always done it.
It's beautiful.
And we still do it. And you know what? When you watch the non-whites gather against the whites, you'll see that they've got to watch that their numbers are more than us. They only start gaining confidence when they say, we outnumber these whites. You know, we can take them. But the white male, he'll fight when he's outnumbered. He'll fight when he's vastly outnumbered. And we've been doing it right up and right even here in Africa. So we're far from finished. Far from finished. The war hasn't even begun, my friend. So no. Take care, and thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure.